Saturday, March 16th, was a stolen day. I hadn't really expected to have it. The gold crisis, the Vietnam troop decision, had been pressing in on Lyndon, so I did not think he could go to Texas for Linda's birthday and to tell Chuck goodbye. So I had put it out of my mind. And then, at a meeting about the Texas park with Doug Hubbard and Dr. Alan Kent and Mr. Hendrickson from the National Park Service, on Friday, they had told me that they could go to Texas on very short notice. I inquired tentatively, like tomorrow? Yes. I'd gotten word through Connie Worth that Lawrence Rockefeller was going to make it possible to have a long-term plan for the Johnson Park done by the National Park Service. And then maybe, I don't know how much, help out with the exhibits. I'd ask Lyndon, and he didn't hesitate a moment. You ought to go to Texas and be with those children every day you can, right up until they leave. And so, Friday afternoon, on the late plane, I'd gone down, arriving after considerable troubles via San Antonio and automobile on to the ranch, a little before 11:30. And Saturday morning, awoke to the most glorious weather, with Mr. Hubbard and Dr. Kent and Mr. Hendrickson, who'd arrived the night before and been put in the cedar house, meeting me for breakfast, bacon and eggs and homemade bread in front of the picture window, looking out on the fields and a glorious blue sky. And then, with Lawrence's binoculars, the four of us set out and toured the park area, getting out at the side of the visitor center, following the string outline of the building itself, and exploring the old log cabin that had been revealed when the Victorian siding was removed, looked at the view of the ranch house from what will be the front porch of the visitor center, and then all around the whole periphery, seeing the longhorn in the pasture grazing, and coming up on the buffalo, actually just within about 10 feet of them in the car, and stopping at the old sour place to look at the long story of man's life here, from the first little log structure to the very German masonry work, white limestone, and then on to the Victorian house with the gingerbread and the oval glass fronts in the door. There's one little portion where they have the story of Texas fences all within about a 50-foot space. A picturesque stone fence, a split rail, barbed wire. They seemed really quite delighted at the potential. I showed them pictures of the wildflowers from my albums, of what we can expect in the spring. And actually, in the backyard of the sour place, I found my first blooming bluebonnet of the season. The ground is thick with them. And I began to get really excited, thinking about our trip April 5th to 9th, and very especially what I hope will be a personal happy trip with close friends on the weekend of San Jacinto Day. We went back to the house without having seen the dance place, which is, after all, the oldest of the log cabins, according to archaeologist Tunnel. Mr. Hubbard has already seen it, and I thought he might take the others later in the day. We got word that Lyndon was on his way, that he would arrive about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I quickly changed the plans for our big meeting to the old birthplace house, slipped into a dress, and we were off to Fredericksburg, where we met Mrs. Art Covert at the Pioneer Museum. She and Mr. Tyrus Cox, whose title is either head of the Historical Association or director of the museum, I'm not sure, and the two wonderful old ladies who take everybody through, Mrs. Brody and Mrs. Deachin, because on the longest tour I've ever had there, a full hour, and I really think it impressed and amazed the Park Service people. They hadn't known the depth of the German culture here. The German language newspaper had flourished beginning shortly after the first settlers came in 1846 until sometime in the 1940s. Mrs. Covert told me the delightful bit about having found in the records of their own paper the announcement of Lyndon's birth in German. And alas, of course, giving him no name. He didn't have one then. I said, how much was it? About 2 lines? And she said, no, about 1.5 lines. Anyway, it would be fun to have. On our way through, I took from my purse my vanity and started to powder my nose. It fell with a sharp crack to the floor. I shivered, and before I could stop myself, said, I hope it didn't break. I picked it up. It had shattered. I thought of the last time I broke a mirror. It was the day that him died. I could see signs of preparation for our visit on the 5th. They're all so excited over it. For one thing, in the kitchen, there's no longer the enormous clutter, dozens upon dozens of old iron kitchen utensils dated 1840, 50, 60, 70. It was just approximately the number that a family living there would have used. And in a big wooden bowl, there were fresh vegetables, just as though someone had brought them in from the garden. And here and there in the living room, where Baron von Moisebach's organ is the outstanding exhibit, there's a bouquet of flowers. So our wonderful little museum is getting into stride with today's idea of how a museum should look. I looked with fresh eyes at some of the display cases. Several of them are quite extraordinary. Enormous glass-fronted pieces of furniture, about 12 or more feet high. They came from one of the old hardware stores going out of business, I heard. I asked how they got all these old artifacts, because the museum only began sometime in the 30s. They said they let it be known that the museum was going to open, and people just dug them up from their trunks and attics and barn lofts. And Mrs. Covert said, in fact, they had had quite an assemblage of them in the office of the paper for years, and they brought all of them over. It's quite a community achievement. I take my hat off to it. We went into the little stone patio, centered by the well, talked about this might be the place where they'd serve coffee and apple strudel to the foreign correspondents. I was proud of our local area. Next, we went to the Touch House, and the Mrs. Muller took us through. Here, I saw another engraving that had been won at the museum of Fredericksburg as it looked in about the 1850s. They told us with pride that the settlers who came over here were not all farmers. Some were artists and musicians. The son of one had gone on to be the conductor of the outstanding symphony orchestras in the United States, New York or Boston, I believe. Yeah. Then we drove around town and looked at the outside of other little Sunday houses, St. Barnabas Church, the octagon-shaped Kirky, the wide street of town designed so that a double ox team could turn around without backing, and headed for home, alerting Mary along the way to have dinner ready for us as soon as we arrived. We sat down to ham and grits, and we just finished when we got word that the plane was coming in, and I went out to the hangar to meet Lyndon, who was preceded out of the plane by Yuki, and he had Patrick Lyndon in his arms. He'd stopped in Austin long enough to gather him. Lucy and Pat were off for a weekend with friends in Nuevo Laredo. The Krems were with him, and I was so glad to see them, because I knew he would have a happy afternoon, riding and talking, and I needed to make use of my afternoon for the park. For some peculiar sentimental reason, I had decided to have this meeting in the room at the Birthplace House, rather than at the Cedar House, perhaps the more logical place. Because I remember the wonderful day we spent in the little house where Lennon was born, with John Macy and John Gardner, and Chancellor Ransom, about 8 of us trying to bring into being the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Service. And so, about 2, we gathered in the west room of the little house, Mr. William Gosden, the head of the Texas State Park, our 3 National Park men, Doug Hubbard and Dr. Kent and Mr. Hendrickson, Curtis Tunnell, the Texas State archaeologist who had written us the long letter about his exploration of the 3 log cabins in the park, Nancy Cott, the exhibits officer for Texas State Parks, Roy White, Dr. Joe France from the university, the historian on whom we will rely for the way that pioneers of that day lived, and Mr. Tyrus Cox, on whom I shall lean heavily to tie us in with local interest and cooperation. There were several more people I'd wanted so much to ask. Wayne Bell, who'd restored the Wynedale Stagecoach Inn, Mrs. Charles Bybee, who's restored a full dozen, perhaps, old places ranging from the 1840s to the 1890s. W.W. Newcomb, head of the Texas Memorial Museum and author of one of the chapters in A President's Country. And of course, I had asked Will Odom, without whom the whole project would never have gotten off the ground. But he was out of town. But the speed with which it had been put together made it difficult to get them all, and we did have a good talking group, which we certainly did do for about 4 hours. We argued pro and con on whether the log cabin right there next to the visitor center should be integrally attached to it, that is, the roof lines combined, just the interior of the cabin used as an exhibit area. Roy held out that it should. All the National Park Service people agreed with him. I felt I didn't know enough to have an opinion. Curtis Tunnell and Miss Cott alone held out for a true restoration, which would necessarily separate it from the visitor center and maybe make it out of place. So we decided to proceed as it was, that is, an integral part of the visitor center. and we all decided that it would be best to set our sights on making it our first exhibit. That is, with a sort of bed and chair and rifle and spinning wheel or whatever, the settler of the 1870s who lived there, for that is about the time that Curtis Tunnel, the archaeologist, says it was built, would have had in his home. And it was right here that one of the most useful statements of the day was made by Mr. Tyrus Cox. He said he thought it would be no problem to find these artifacts, these articles that the pioneers lived with. He thought that people still had them and would be proud to donate them. I'll believe it when it happens, but it was a mighty cheering statement, and I'm sure the museum in Fredericksburg itself has many that it cannot effectively display. I venture to hope that any that they may have in storage, they might be generous enough to lend us with proper credit. Mr. Tunnel talked about some explorations, that is, diggings around the three cabins, to find any bits and pieces of the things those pioneers had lived with, the sort of kitchen midden idea, or to find foundations of outside buildings. Mr. France outlined for the National Park Service people the history of the area, the German immigration, the Indians before that. Incidentally, Curtis Tunnel said there wasn't Indian mound, not any particularly exciting possibilities, but there on the park premises. I think it was a consensus of opinion. The National Park Service will proceed with an overall plan, and that in about 2 weeks, Mr. Garson and Mr. Tunnel and Nancy Cott will come to Washington and go to their laboratories to discuss further with them their plans. The theme of the exhibits is life in the area in times past, Indians, Germans, cattle drives, but although there will probably be a map and some mention of the complex surrounding the president's home, the ranch house itself, the house where he was born, the family cemetery, his grandfather's home, the little school he first attended, all of these will be very simply pointed out, low-key and minor, as long as we are in public office. This was what I kept on insisting on, and I think the idea was acceptable to everybody. I kept on bringing us back to the point that if the contract was let in May as they planned, the building would probably be finished between November 68 or January 69, and that we must have some sort of an exhibit for then. What would it be? And the assets that we had to go on were some very handsome longhorns, several rather ratty-looking buffalo, plenty of white-tailed deer, three old log cabins, and a view of the president's house. Taken from there, what could we produce between now and next Christmas, let's say? It was a meeting full of enthusiasm, with a good deal of rabbit chasing, as Lyndon would express it, but a lot of good suggestions tossed around and some decided on. And to me, it was another step forward in one of the dreams I hoped to see come to pass. Of course, I got in my word for plenty of wildflower seeds and for slides of the wildflowers of the Edwards Plateau to be viewed perhaps in one of those participating exhibits where you just punch a button. We went up to the main house close to 6 and had beer and noche specials, made plans to keep in touch, each with the person with the particular expertise that he needed to explore further, and I insisting to Mr. Hubbard and something that I did think it would be quite appropriate whenever they could for Mr. Kent and Mr. Hendrickson to see the little fort complex in Johnson City, meet Jesse Hunter and Betty Weinheimer, and get a sort of a forecast of how many people might come to see this exhibit once it was done, to talk with Wayne Bell and Mrs. Charles Bybee about restorations. In short, there was much to be done in the locality, if they had the time to. He felt that they would return to Washington the next morning, so we made them reservations, and I sent them down to the Lewis house to spend the night, half of me anxious to go with them and talk about it further, and the other half anxious to get out in the car and join Lyndon and Linda Bird and Chuck, who had come in about 4 or 5 o'clock, and the Crims. It ended by Roy taking them to the Lewis place, and I set out at once. We rode until dark drove us in. Pastures are already starred with a few little pink phlox and lots of blue-eyed grass. The elms are coming out first, and the red oak in the backyard is just beginning to bud. We stopped once, and I explored the northwest pasture in the 80 acres where I put out the bluebonnet seed. There's a sprinkling, a justification, no great mass, alas. There's been so much rain, I despair of ever getting our trees planted, the big live oak outside of my bedroom window, and we definitely have lost one of the live oaks by Mr. Klein's workshop. Otherwise, the place is looking great, and I have Lyndon's permission to take down the bubble top over the swimming pool before we get back on April 5th. John Hills and the Morsons came for dinner. Vanderbilt and Chuck were on their daddy's right, the Krims and Marie and Diana Hodges, and it was a happy evening. I wonder if anybody who had been watching us would have thought it strange that there was so little mention of the big event of the day, Bobby Kennedy's announcing. It had been in the back of my mind all day long because I knew he was going to have a press conference in the morning, but it was not until the park people left that I could ask somebody in our office, I think it was, what he had actually done and said. Yes, it's official. He's running. And then, just before dinner, Arthur Krim described his statement. He considered it dangerous. He was running not on personality reasons, he said, but to save the country from a perilous course from the Vietnamese War. Arthur is deeply worried, I can see, and I bless him for caring. The Morsons and the Hills I would describe as just angry, and Lyndon as philosophical. He'd known it all along, I think, since the moment Bobby Kennedy walked into his office the first time after John Kennedy's death. It was Lyndon who suggested that we see Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and we all went out to the hangar, which is completed now for showing movies and very nice, except that it's hard to see from the back rows because there is no incline. I stayed for about the first 30 minutes of it and then went in. Linda and Chuck had gone in, and Linda and I had a good long talk all about Acapulco, how she feels, their plans. The others came back into the living room about 11:30 and amazingly did not leave at once. Talked about the movie. It's odd that Lyndon should admire it, should find it so interesting that he would see it twice when he usually goes to sleep after the first 10 minutes of any movie. Tilda is sure that this is a shape of things to come, and I sadly expect it is. A.W. is solidly against it and doesn't want it to be shown to impressionable young people. He is a conservative to his bones, and I doubt that the changing world around him will change him, although he may be the last of a breed. The gold situation is teetering perilously, close to some black chasm, and from the little I know, it seems that the French are hurting us as much as they can, and the British helping us as much as they can, and Lyndon, Joe Fowler, all the administration people working as hard as they can to achieve some stability in it. And so, with this mixture of problems and blessings, my dear husband went to bed about midnight. And I remembered what amusing little vignette of the morning at the Thatch House, when Miss Muller was describing the early life of the German settlers in the 1850s. She showed us a little pewter lamp, and she said they used bear grease as a fuel in it. I asked, do we have bear in this country? And she said, yes. The Indians would kill them, put the grease in deer skin sacks, and bring them into town to sell. It was used in frying and as fuel for lamps. And she described how the peace that Baron von Marsebach made with the Comanche Indians included terms of trade where they would come into the community and bring things to sell.